It is time for Family Business Radio. Every week through Family Business Radio, we're showcasing family businesses and building a community designed to educate, inform, and support family-owned business right here in Georgia. Each week, our guests include the actual family business owners, key executive non-family members who are helping to drive those businesses, and the trusted professional advisors that assist them. I am your hostess, Meredith Moore, with Moore & Associates Wealth Management, and I am very excited to introduce our guest today, Mr. Ed Butler, who is the chairman of the Butler Group. Welcome.
Thank you, Meredith.
It's good to have you here, and you know, I'd like to tell our listeners, I actually met you at Kennesaw. Obviously, we always talk about their family business center, but they had a family business forum, and I met you there, and we were actually listening to George Manners speak, who was our guest last week.
It's quite interesting, too.
Yeah, he, you know, I think he really hit the nail on the head when he was talking about really education within the generations from a financial standpoint and whether companies should take on debt or not and how all those things kind of intertwine together. But we're here to talk about you today. So we've got the Butler Group. Let's start kind of from the beginning. You graduated from college. This is before the business. You know, what industry did you go into?
I went into retail. I went into, and so many times I tell people, you know, young people, and would they get their start? And I say, well, I was a janitor, actually. I was a janitor in a department store and going to school. And I always tried to give a little extra wherever I did. And, you know, it got me recognized. And then accepted into the training program for management, and so I spent 21 years with Montgomery Ward.
Wow. And Montgomery Ward isn't here in Georgia, but it's part of the Federated Group, right?
Actually, they're gone. They're out of business,
right?
Now,
so. Okay. Now at some point were they ever here in Georgia? I know I've seen them in the Southeast. I was thinking
they were not strong if they had anything. They were a Midwest company,
right?
And through Texas.
Okay. And so that eventually brought you to Federated at some point?
I was, when my job at Montgomery Ward was eliminated,
right,
in 1982, mm-hmm, then Rich's Department Stores, Federated, hired me, moved us here to Atlanta.
Right, and of course everybody in Atlanta knows Rich's.
Where I managed some of their stores.
So you know retail like the back of your hand, I'm guessing. Then.
Oh, that's, I grew up in retail. And
so what happened in 1988? All of a sudden, you're working and you were doing the corporate gig. Obviously, you left Rich's at that point. And how did you figure out what the next step was?
You know, it just, as I reflect on the life that I was living at that time, is that I wanted to have a job that wouldn't be eliminated like it was for Montgomery Ward.
Right.
When that happened, you know, I was set for retirement with that company.
Sure.
And, of course, you know now almost nobody works for a company until they retire.
Sure.
Same company. But anyway, that put me on to the idea that I'd really like to have our own business, something that we could depend on ourselves and really get what we earn and not depend on somebody else for a paycheck.
At that time, would you have classified yourself as an entrepreneur, or was this kind of a new foray trying to make that transition?
I would say we've had some entrepreneurial experience because before this came about, we bought rental properties. We bought, you know, we've been doing that for several years,
mm-hmm,
and that's how we developed enough savings to be able to buy a business and got it started that way.
So you went to a business broker here in Atlanta, right?
I did.
And what kind of opportunities were you looking at? What spoke to you at that time?
First was retail.
Just
because of my background with retail, I knew a lot about everything from a paint store, hardware store. I even looked at a truck tire center because I had that kind of experience. I had, mm-hmm, building materials experience, so many other categories, including the clothing and other things. But you know, every time I'd look at a retail store for sale,
mm-hmm,
then I would see stodgy inventory that needed to be liquidated. I could see why they wanted to sell it. It was suffering, and it was in a bad economic situation, not competitive in their markets or whatever the reason might be. And then I came across, there's a couple of these manufacturer representative companies mm-hmm. for sale. And mm-hmm. I have really never knew about this business. Mm-hmm. And it just fascinated me that you could be a manufacturer representative mm-hmm. with a showroom and with a minimal amount of investment for samples mm-hmm. for the showroom and a commitment or a lease on the showroom space that you are financially obligated to.
Right.
And you could develop a business this way.
And so I would assume going into a new business with that, the biggest cost, like you said, would be the lease of the showroom at that point.
It is, yeah.
And did you have to buy a lot of inventory up front, or were you able to acquire some of that?
Actually, most manufacturers supply that. Some charge some part of it, but it wasn't expensive.
Really?
It was really just the lease of the showroom and whatever salaries that you have to pay out to the people.
Right.
And for the first 2 years, my wife and I took no salary.
Of course.
We just did it for the building the future.
Like any good startup, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so your wife is Betty. And so both of you guys, you bought the business, you went in cold turkey, but with a large background in retail. So what did you start out? What were you selling?
We were selling baskets, of all things. And that, okay. at that time, baskets were popular. And I remember that we sold baskets to Cracker Barrel stores, for example, and mm-hmm. and they would have a room within their gift shop of nothing but baskets. The baskets would fit the food products or whatever they were selling, and people would just buy baskets because they love baskets. Well, today baskets aren't even an issue. I mean, you could get a gift basket,
right? But that's about it.
Or flowers in a basket, maybe. But
now, were most of your clients at this point, were they bigger companies like Cracker Barrel, or were individuals coming in through the store or through the showroom rather to take a look?
Mostly, they came to the showroom.
Okay.
And so we had at that time about 3,000 accounts that bought from us at the showroom, and then we had 5 sales reps that called on the stores, called on the road. They called on the road, calling mm-hmm. on the stores, and the business was pretty much isolated to baskets. Basket company that we were representing mm-hmm. at that time was 90% of our total business, and only about 10% of other gift items.
That could be kind of scary if baskets go out of favor.
Well, it did, and of course that company is no longer in business.
Right.
And so, right away we had to start diversifying and getting other product lines.
Well, now your showroom now is in the America's Mart. Was it originally too when you started the business?
Well, when we started the business, we were in the Mart downtown, okay. but okay. it wasn't called America's Mart. It was in the Merchandise Mart building.
Right.
At that time, there was a Merchandise Mart and an Apparel Mart.
Right.
And then that was before the Gift Mart building was built. And then after the Gift Mart building was built, and mm-hmm. with the 3 buildings all connected with over-the-street walkways,
right.
it became America's Mart, and that's what it was branded.
Right, and again, mm-hmm. having grown up in Atlanta, I know that it's always evolved, and we always hear people buying great deals on jewelry and everything else down there. So you've seen it since, not inception, but obviously in the last 20 years, you've seen things evolve pretty much down
there. It's been 25 years now.
Yeah.
It's 1988 when we started.
Right. So after the basket, I wouldn't call it a foray, but after you had to diversify the business outside of baskets, what kind of lines were you trying to go in for?
With our just taking the initial customer base mm-hmm. of 3,000 stores, and we analyzed what kind of stores are they, what other products would they sell, mm-hmm. and we went for items, other product lines that would go into the same customers, whether they were stores or gift basket companies or
right.
like Cracker Barrel, for example. There's just a lot of different things that go into those stores make them interesting.
Like something with a southern flair, I guess, is...
Well, yeah, because our territory is the southeast,
right.
and so we do look for lines that are attractive to the southeast people, which is different from Boston, for example.
Or right, sure, of course.
Different lifestyles, different parts of the country.
Now, when people are coming through... I mean, are you finding that they're there to, they own a business themselves, they're trying to find inventory that might be appropriate to what they're trying to sell? Or so when people come through the mart, who are those accounts or those customers at that time?
Well, first let me say that the Atlanta America's Mart does a fabulous job of marketing to the trade.
Got it.
So Atlanta has become the number one market of all, the whole nation.
Wow.
More people come to Atlanta to buy than any other market, including New York, Dallas, whatever. And wow. So it's known for that. People come, and then, of course, the people, the showrooms like ours that develop a reputation for having good products are on the list, on a short list of must-see showrooms.
So and somebody comes in and they know, for example, that say it was 1988 and they were looking for baskets, they would know that they need to be stopping by
absolutely
your showroom.
In fact, when that initially that company left us about a year or so after we started, after we bought the company, and so we were facing extinction almost immediately.
It was scary, yeah.
It was. And so we started interviewing other basket companies and found out that we were pretty famous in the industry. And we had no trouble at all attracting other companies that had baskets they'd like to get into our customer accounts.
So you started creating sort of a good history for other potential people that you all wanted to use some of their products, if you will, and market them out there to clients and so forth. So you guys have a family, you have kids, you have three kids. It's 1988. How old were your kids at this point?
Well, I have to think back. Well, if I subtract 25 years.
Yeah, exactly.
So at that time, we had one that would have been just finishing college, maybe a little bit past that, and then the others are in college and in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So and I will say this, that at that time, and for several years after that, all three of our kids said they never wanted to be in this business.
Interesting.
They said, we work too hard. They don't want to have to do that.
And I think for generation two, we always find in the beginning the grass is always greener, and it's whether they end up coming back. So were they involved in the business even as kids? Did you have them even cleaning? Or?
Well, our son Greg actually worked for one of our businesses we were importing wicker baskets and furniture after, you know, like a second phase of that basket business.
Mm-hmm.
And he did work for the warehouse manager and while he was in high school, got a grade, you know, came in after school and got some credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
And even our second daughter, who went to work for a jewelry company out of college. She got her degree in theater and then did a bit part for Heat of the Night here and did some commercials,
wow,
different things, found out she couldn't make any money doing that.
Yeah. Reality set in, huh?
And so she came to us to see if we could find a job for her in our company, and we did. And her first job was driving a mobile showroom, which was was like one of these airport buses,
right,
that we stripped out the seats and put shelves in and made a mobile showroom. And so she drove around to mostly florists and people that would buy baskets.
Right.
And then Greg was at the warehouse, and he would ship them the next day to the people. And that was a kind of a small business that we had going at that time. And that was the first thing that was available. And after that, she came to work for us as a sales rep for our company.
And this is Paula, your middle daughter?
Okay. Paula, mm-hmm. And after Greg worked at the warehouse, then this was in 2003 that Paula then became a sales rep for the Butler Group.
Okay.
And then in 2004, just 6 months later, Greg came to work for the Butler Group as a showroom manager.
That's great.
Yeah.
And now, so Christy's the oldest, but she was the last person.
She said she was a director for Mary Kay Cosmetic Company.
And she's a director. She was getting on up there.
She was gung-ho. She loved it, and she worked hard at it.
Right.
And she said she would never work. Never come to work for us, that she just didn't want to leave Mary Kay.
Mm-hmm.
And
I would think there would be a little bit of overlap in the sales process to some degree.
There are certainly some skills.
Right, sure.
Selling skills that
right.
can be transferred. Well, Christy homeschooled her two children.
Okay.
And she needed that flexibility to be home and do that.
Mm-hmm.
When her oldest then was ready to go to college, she came to us to see if she could get a job with our company,
right.
which is more a little more substantial income.
Mm-hmm.
And so she went on the road as a sales rep for the Butler Group.
Okay.
Now, that's interesting to think about, because what happened was I didn't have an opening. I didn't have a territory.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I did is I gave her the customers that the other salespeople wouldn't call on.
And why would they not call?
Well, they prioritize. You know, they're going
right,
to call.
The A, B, and C
right.
clients. These were like the C clients,
right,
basically.
Right.
Okay, got it. Hey, and then you can see if she's made it.
So
she's made
that's
it.
Right.
Yeah.
So she did. And she took these accounts and she started developing them. And they started doing good business with us. And so, you know, it showed what she's made of. She could go out there and do that. And then so it was after that that we developed another business for that she was able to help us with, which is now our baby business, which she now helps me run it. I mean, she takes a lot of responsibility
mm-hmm.
In the Maison Chic business.
And let's come back to that. But originally you had said you had five sales reps. So obviously the business has grown. So how many sales reps do you have now?
So I think we have, I say that because I'm not as involved now,
right, sure.
but I think it's 18
mm-hmm.
right now. And Paula runs the sales organization.
Right.
And she has a director of sales that works with her on that.
Mm-hmm.
And
are there territories now,
we
like
have,
defined?
Right, exactly. Each rep lives in a state or a part of a state,
mm-hmm.
and then their territory is typically within 200 miles of where they live.
Okay, so not everybody's here in Atlanta and flying out.
No.
Okay.
We have two sales reps who live in the Atlanta metropolitan area
mm-hmm.
that divide the state of Georgia, northern Georgia.
Right.
And then we have another rep in for South Georgia.
Yeah, that's central Georgia, I guess, just before Macon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So things have clearly grown in that respect. Now, you've begun, as you said, kind of creating some little subsidiary businesses that are really starting to get developed. And you mm-hmm. said Christy was responsible for this baby business. Talk to me about this baby business.
Well, here's what happened. We were representing a company called Maison Chic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a factory direct where the factory owners had set up a distribution in the United States and hired a manager to run it. And he couldn't handle it. And so it closed. So then in July 2008, the owner of the factory flew in to see Betty and me to see if mm-hmm. we would manage that business for her.
Right.
And at that time, I said, I would do it. Mm-hmm. I could do it, but you couldn't pay me to do
right,
it.
Right, exactly.
I would do it if I owned it.
Right.
But this goes back, and I wanted to bring this up, to a family council meeting that we had
mm-hmm.
in preparation before we ever decided to buy a business.
Mm-hmm.
We had talked about our retirement, what are we going to do with our business, because our business was just the Butler Group as a sales rep agency
right,
at
sure.
that time. And we had our kids working in the business, and we needed the business to provide them a job.
Sure.
So then we thought, well, what are we going to do if we sell the company? Is
all
a new
the
owner
right.
going to hire our people, our children,
right?
or are they going to be left out? And so we would lose control on that. And we decided that we needed help. So that's when we went to Kennesaw State University.
Right.
And Dr.
Astrakhan.
Joe Astrakhan.
Yeah, of course.
And Christy McMillan came out to visit with us,
mm-hmm.
spent most of a day,
mm-hmm.
and interviewed each one of our kids, talked to us as a group, and kind of led us into how to have family council meetings. And we started then having those family council meetings mm-hmm. where we talked about our future business and what where we need to go, what we need to do. And so they became a part of our retirement or our exit planning or what, you know, where do we go and where do they go
right,
kind
sure.
of a thing. And that was very helpful to us.
And that's a good thing. We've had Christy and Joe on the show multiple times, and sometimes getting that clarity on where everybody fits in sort of the puzzle can be a wonderful thing to make sure that things mm-hmm. go as they're supposed to.
So it was one of these family council meetings right after that mm-hmm. we had that for the first time I told our kids how much money we made and how do we make money. And that was really awkward for me because my parents never talked about money.
I don't think anybody likes to talk to their kids about how much money they make. Yeah. What did your kids say to that? Were they surprised or?
I don't know. They didn't. I mean, it's almost like neutral.
Right. Sure.
You know what? They think, well, we're living well, but they don't know how much money it takes to live well, you know, so.
Right.
And of course, I explained to them that it took so many years
right.
for accumulated wealth and
building the business up too.
Yeah. And so, but anyway, in that meeting, we were talking about our margins of profit.
Mm-hmm.
In our sales agency are very small. We work on
really?
Commission.
Okay.
We strictly work on commission.
And so it's not margin per product that you sell?
No. No, it's just you work on a commission, like real estate.
Okay, got it.
You'd work on commission. And the commission is limited. And so, and you're sharing that commission with the sales reps.
Okay, yep.
So you're really, you know, it's really hard to make much money
right,
in that
sure.
business. So the idea came about that we should see what product lines that we could develop of our own so mm-hmm. that we would have the margin of the manufacturer.
Well, and you've got the distribution system already laid out there.
Right. And the fact is we have been showing and exhibiting how to do this to manufacturers all along.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they come to us and they're not doing any business, and then we help them grow their business, and then they might leave us, and then we mm-hmm. have no equity in their business because
right.
it's not our business. It's their business.
You taught them how to be good and do what
so,
you guys have done.
Yeah, so with that in mind, we decided we want to do this,
mm-hmm.
but we weren't ready to do that. We didn't have any opportunity to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when Maison Chic that we were representing, when mm-hmm. it closed, and then the factory owner came to visit us, that was our first opportunity. So we were already prepared mentally. Mm-hmm. To say, yes, we want a business, and this is an opportunity for our business. And so we just presented it that way, and we joined a joint venture partnership. The woman and her husband and Betty and me were 50-50 partners
sure.
in the business, and it's our job to sell to North America, North and South America.
Mm-hmm.
She has some European customers. She sells from the factory, and...
So they do all the manufacturing. You guys are the distribution
right.
system.
And so she's responsible for the final say on the design of the product as
mm-hmm.
well as the manufacturing of it. We give a lot of our input on the design
mm-hmm.
As to what sells in the United States.
And what it's a you said it's some sort of baby company, but describe more.
It's a textile-related baby gift products.
Okay.
And so we would have...
What, like baby blankets?
Oh, you have blankets, you have bibs, you have burp pads, we have travel pillows, toys.
Got it.
Little security blankies and
okay.
all the like.
Fun.
So we have every design comes in collections.
Mm-hmm.
And so we print our own fabric designs and everything is proprietary to our company.
So where is the plant or the manufacturing?
It's in Qingdao. China.
Okay. Okay, got it. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. quite the place where everybody's producing stuff right now. So it's certainly a lot cheaper, mm-hmm. it seems like, these days than the U.S. So you have, you said, Chris. So Christy is running.
She is definitely my main support in mm-hmm. that company, and she does a lot of work. She's executive vice president of sales and product development.
Mm-hmm. So how has she taken the existing client base? Because that baby niche might be very different from if you're selling a basket, where you're dealing with a florist versus and maybe not?
Here's the there is a difference. With a baby gift, a person gives a something that they love to give.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when you give a gift for a baby, it's you're not using yourself. You're you're giving that gift, and that's the gift you want to give.
Mm-hmm.
The next baby's born, you could buy the same gift and give it to another baby.
Sure.
All right. The difference is, if you're buying something for yourself, you just buy it once.
Right. Sure. That's true.
You don't need two.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. Unless you have twins, I guess.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Right.
Yeah. So okay. So you're able to, you know, continue to use this current infrastructure of the client base as well too. And was there a ton of overlap in terms of?
Well, a big advantage that I had too is that our showroom is known nationally, and and we do have sales reps coming to our showroom looking for lines to represent from all over the United States. And so it was not difficult for me to get sales reps in other territories to cover our Maison Chic product line. And so we do have now not only gift sales reps across the United States, but we also have baby store reps across the United States.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so I think we have about maybe close to 150 salespeople now selling that line.
That's great. And so they're calling on a lot of the baby boutiques. And I know not just the Babies R Us, but there's other bigger baby stores that are out there that are trying to be cutting edge with cute stuff as opposed to the big box store in terms of baby.
Yeah, there's a brand philosophy there.
Okay.
Is that for baby, for Maison Chic, it's a specialty store product.
Right. Okay.
There's a lot of handwork. It's a little higher priced than what you might buy at a Target or Walmart.
Right, sure, of course.
And it's a little more special. So when you want to give a nice gift, you want to give something nicer than they would buy for themselves you know, as a commodity.
Right, sure.
So at the same time, you need the price has to be affordable and meet those gift price points that people want to pay for a gift.
Right.
So if somebody wants to pay $25 for a nice baby gift,
mm-hmm.
you could find a nice gift for $25 or $20, even $15. It might not be as nice for $15.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
At retail, yeah.
So when did you create the joint venture? What year was that?
That was our first meeting was in July of 2008.
Okay. So you've been able to trial and error this thing a little bit to figure out, hey, can you take on other brands or other types of products to figure out where the holes are, it sounds like.
That's true. And what happened, she came over to see us in July of 2008.
Right.
We went to China in September of 2008 to get review the product line, get up and going. We introduced it in January of 2009. So our real start was January 2009, and so we're just going into our fourth year.
What were some of the obstacles you felt like you had in the beginning once you had your salespeople out there on the road?
Oh, yeah, there's a big obstacle when a company goes out of business.
Yeah.
We talked about, should we keep the same name or not?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as we surveyed some customers and thought more about it, we determined that people liked the Maison Chic product.
Mm-hmm.
What they didn't like was they didn't get it.
Right.
So we kept the name and just went out with a policy that if somebody was unhappy, we would bend over backwards or do some things for them to get them back on the fold and, you know, the retailers that had bought it before. And we really didn't have to do much. They really just wanted the product. So
wow, that's great. So the demand was already built in. You just had to create the supply and have the backing.
Right. So we did have to come pony up some money.
Right, sure.
We had to go to, because when you make in China, you have to buy a lot.
Of course, yeah. The quantity alone, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So you've created another, you took what you've done with Maison Chic, and now you've created another sort of.
Well, in that first family meeting when we talked about developing a business. The first idea was jewelry because, A, it's small, easy to ship, and women love it. It's like candy.
Right.
And Paula, our daughter, had experience out of college working for a jewelry company. And so we had that to go on to. And then Betty is she's very much into accessorizing, and so it was just the kind of thing that it was easy to know what's good and what's not good, and so we didn't have so the Maison Chic opportunity came first, but we talked about the jewelry before that.
Right.
So it was in March of 2009 that we introduced Kaleidoscope Accessories.
Right.
As a jewelry company, it's jewelry and accessories, and it has grown till now we have over 2,000 items in jewelry, handbags, scarves, complete accessories.
So since you own the line, I guess the you were talking about how the commissions were so small with having to split with the reps, it's you're able to make it a more profitable line per se than something else that you're acting mm-hmm. as a representative on the behalf of somebody else, I would assume.
Yes. And I will say that it's the companies are all separated.
Right.
So this is interesting, is that our son Greg runs the showroom, mm-hmm. and he charges every manufacturer for the amount of space they take in the showroom.
Right.
He charges us just like any other mm-hmm. any other vendor that the company represents. So Paula and Greg mm-hmm. work for the Butler Group.
Right.
Christy works for Maison Chic.
Mm-hmm.
And then Kaleidoscope is Betty and my
right.
company. And we just we have to pay just like anybody else has to pay.
I guess it's no different than owning a commercial property and your business, you know, mm-hmm. pays yourself the rent or whatever for it.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, and that's definitely intriguing. What kind of jewelry is it? I'd like to hear more about.
It's really impulse fashion jewelry.
Is it costume jewelry then?
Yeah, okay. Costume. You can say costume. It's all right.
Yeah, sorry. That's probably bad. I don't know.
No, it's all right. It's
I'm not selling diamonds.
I'll say it's disposable.
Yeah.
It's impulse.
Got it. Okay.
You know? It's
Got
not
it.
Expensive.
Okay. And so who have some of the, as you've developed Kaleidoscope, who are some of the clients or your customers on that particular line? What kind of stores and...
You know, they're the same stores that bought our lines from the Butler Group, and the same thing is true with Maison Chic, our baby line. It's the same kind of stores. Gift stores now sell more jewelry than apparel stores. This was about 2 years ago that a survey indicated that was already happening.
Hmm.
And
why do you think that is?
I think that it happened as a result, partly as a result of the downturn in the economy.
Yeah.
With the home building going down,
mm-hmm.
and where stores in the past may have sold home accent pieces.
Right. Okay.
And when people aren't moving, they're not buying mm-hmm. home accent pieces as much. You know,
okay.
you might say, well, you know, you could freshen up your home, but everybody knows that when you move, you really do redo the home. You
right,
know?
Sure.
And so that really took a toll on the whole industry, and most people don't really understand or don't even think about the ripple effect.
Right.
Of selling a home and how many other industries are involved.
So did you see that? Were you guys representing any home accent pieces
before? We were, yeah. We still do.
Right.
But we had more home accent as a balance
right.
within the line mat package. And the retail stores that we're selling to mm-hmm. also were counting on the sale of, let's say, for example, mm-hmm. Pictures, wall decor.
Right.
If you have framed pictures you put on the wall. That could have been a big volume business for a store, and they might have carried 60 to 100 frame pictures at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, every day somebody would come in and need a picture for a room, or a decorator would be redoing a home, and they could use a lot of pictures in the home and things like that. Well, when that changed, then the store owners had to find some other avenue.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the psychology of Americans
mm-hmm.
is, and I'm not an expert at this, I'll just say from my experience.
Right, sure, yeah.
Is that they want to spend.
Okay.
And when the money isn't there, you know, they're going to spend it on something personal, something less.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a feel-good thing
mm-hmm.
to buy a piece of jewelry that you didn't spend too much money. You might have spent $15 to $30.
Mm-hmm.
and it really makes you feel good, and it makes your outfit look great. Mm-hmm. And you didn't have to buy the whole outfit. You just bought a new necklace, an earring set, you know, it looks good. And so, as that evolved, then the jewelry became the number one category for gift stores at 11%, as surveys indicated up to this past year ago. So it's even grown since then. Additionally, accessories has added another 7%. So ladies' purses, scarves, you know, all the slippers or flip-flops or anything else that a gift store might sell in that category, totally comes out to be about 17 or 18% of the total store's business.
Wow.
It's really a significant volume.
What's considered, since we're on the topic, I mean, what are considered the most popular items in gift stores? I mean, again, 11% is great, but where's the other?
If you come down the list, then you have Christmas.
Right, okay.
And there's baby is 5%. It's a good one. Mm-hmm. And then you have candle accessories mm-hmm. that go in there, or come in there. What is surprising to most people is that picture frames, which has always been a major category for gift stores, produces less than 1% now.
Really?
And I think a lot of that has to do with digitizing the pictures, you know, digital pictures and things like that. And people have other ways of looking and viewing their photos. Baby pictures still go in a frame, you know, a lot of times to show on the desk.
So you have to be really nimble with what's cutting edge and be listening to your customers. Hey, Ed, this stuff isn't selling, you know, economies are changing, mm-hmm. and be able to switch to other products, or your sales reps do, and figure out, hey, what's hot, what's new, what's reflective of what's going on economically.
It's certainly a challenge.
Yeah. How do you stay ahead of that? I mean, how do you stay cutting edge? I mean, obviously, I guess between Paula and Christy, I mean, they can keep figuring out, hey, are there new products that we need to be putting out there? For example, let's just go out on a limb and say in the next 5 years, the economy does swing back.
Mm-hmm.
And home sales start going up.
Right.
So then you've got to turn, I guess, and start getting more home access.
Well, you said it. I mean, you know. You already know because you just said it.
Yeah.
Because if you're just aware of what's going on around you,
mm-hmm.
if home building mm-hmm. picks up and you start seeing in the news
mm-hmm.
what's going on with home building, well, that's the leading indicator.
How do you guys make decisions, though, in terms of acquiring inventory ahead of the game? It's like you don't want to get it too early, but you want to still be cutting edge.
Well, we don't have to buy inventory except for our own product.
True.
Lines.
Okay. Got it.
So if we're representing, you know, so that gives us a lot of flexibility.
Right.
To within the Butler Group product lines.
Right.
To represent companies that are going to be the best opportunity for the environment, the economical environment.
Do your reps kind of explain to the clients, you know, hey, this is what's going on, you know, in anticipation of this, you really might consider mm-hmm. ramping up some of your home accent pieces, let's say?
We try to inform our sales reps
right.
about these things mm-hmm. so that they can in turn inform their customers about these things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of the stores do depend on their sales rep mm-hmm. to inform them about what's going on in the market.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these store owners are in their home, in their stores and not mm-hmm. getting out.
Right.
They don't have the opportunity to see all that. And so that's kind of what we do. I mean, that's part of what our selling is. It's not just selling stuff in the stores. It's really helping the store to be successful.
Right. Well,
in
you
the
have
right
to have
way.
Track records and show them, hey, this is mm-hmm. what's popular. And so you're seeing distinct, or you see distinct different trends, even in the Southeast, but state by state?
Well, one thing that's kind of interesting, maybe to somebody that's not in the industry wouldn't notice it, but when you go to other markets, you don't see the bright colors that you see in the South.
Really?
It's in Atlanta and Dallas.
Right.
You see a lot of bright colors.
Okay.
New York still wears black. Yeah. Once in a while, you see some beige mixed
right.
in there. You know?
Yeah, living on the edge. Huh?
You know, and that's one of the things. And you know how important it is in the South to have monogramming and personalization.
Okay.
And you go to other parts of the United States and you just don't see it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But you don't see any major differences from, say, a Mississippi versus a Florida?
Well, there are regional differences.
Right.
But they're subtle.
Right. Okay.
The core lines are still the important lines.
Interesting.
It's kind of like, Macy's department stores is not, I'll just say, it's not doing the same job that Rich's did.
Right.
When Rich's could customize a store assortment.
Right.
And the stores in certain parts of town would have different kinds of products than other stores.
Right.
And there'd be some stores that had a more affluent neighborhood, and
right.
then we'd have a couture level price in there.
Sure.
Well, now the stores don't have that.
Right.
So now the stores they have ABC level stores, and if your volume is small, then you just get the smaller assortment,
yeah.
and then the larger store gets more assortment. And that's the advantage that the specialty stores have that we sell to
right.
is they customize their assortment based on their clients and their neighborhood.
Right. Well, and that makes sense. I mean, they're going to have not as much inventory, and they can afford mm-hmm. to really feed to that demographic right there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any other interesting trends going on in your business right now in the next year or so that you guys are trying to stay on top of? I mean, obviously, you're figuring this baby thing out. You've got the jewelry thing. Like you said, people with the economy are wanting to get something nice. They're still spending money. Is there mm-hmm. anything else?
You know, within each category, there are trends that develop. And I'll just say one right now. This year is the year of the scarf.
Okay.
For example. I mean,
really?
Scarves are a real easy way to accessorize.
Sure.
And
they're starting to come back. They were huge in the 80s.
I'll just give this example. We tried scarves.
Right.
And it didn't work.
Right.
And then in January, they just took off. I mean, it's really big. And by July, we're going to have a lot of scarves going into fall. But
wow.
But previously, we'd tried scarves and didn't do so well. We had
This is within the Kaleidoscope line?
Within Kaleidoscope. And another category that did well was belts. And there was a time when we sold a lot of belts.
Uh-huh.
And then belts died as a category.
Huh.
And so, you know, we had to liquidate them at a loss.
Some of this you just don't know.
No.
You can't listen to the news and
no.
know that belts aren't going to sell this year.
No. We do watch a lot of the catalogs that come in our mail. You know, we get Neiman Marcus to Chico's to whatever, you mm-hmm. know, a lot of companies. And we see what they're showing.
Mm-hmm.
It may or may not be what our independent stores will buy.
Right.
Another trend that's developed this year is gold has improved a lot in the sales. You know, so where silver, it was all silver
mm-hmm.
up until this year. I mean, it's like 90% silver. There's a little bit of gold out there. But now gold is increasing. Silver still more than gold, but you know, we're seeing more interest in buying gold.
We've had two major jewelers here in Atlanta on the show, and last year it was crazy. One of them is a very high-end jewelry store here in Atlanta, and he's like, I've never had silver on my floor.
Mm.
But with what was happening with the cost of gold, they were having to be able to sell nice pieces. So
mm-hmm.
certainly I think anybody in the gift or the jewelry business was having to adapt with what was going on economically with some of the costs of the goods and so
forth. Well, I can't speak for gold, real gold and real
right.
silver.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just talking about the color.
Oh, got it.
The
okay.
color of gold and the color mm-hmm. of silver. And so we have a lot that's rhodium plated. But,
okay.
It's just a look.
Yeah.
See, I see you're wearing silver.
There you go.
You've got silver earrings, silver ring. Silver,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a silver kind of gal. Yeah, I've never really worn gold. So tell me this. We talked about the family council meetings, but I want to back up to the whole sort of Butler family entity. So you guys went to one of the family business, or Joe and Christy came out, kind of gave you guys some advice on, hey, you need to get the right child to the right position, and you guys created these family council meetings. What do these family council meetings look like? How often do you have them? Talk to me about them in more detail.
Well, you kind of mentioned about how we found out, how we determined what each child should do, their role, and I think that's significant. I interviewed each one of them privately.
That's
and
good.
To say, I want to know what you want out of life. Where do you want to be? What do you like to do? I've always been a big advocate of, even in college, take the courses you really enjoy taking, you know, and then you'll find your way. And so Paula just loved theater. Well, I thought, well, I don't know, maybe it'd work, you know. Actually, we're in the theater business in a way because everybody's on stage when the during showtime.
Of course.
And Greg just loved art, and he took every art class the colleges would allow. I mean, if they had a ceramic, three-dimensional art, charcoal, oil painting, he took everything. He took art courses for 6 or 7 years, I think, and so this is the way I approached it. I said, what is it you really enjoy doing? Because I want this job to be fun. And so each one of them told me what they liked.
Were you surprised with any of the answers?
No, but what I was surprised is that I also asked them, tell me what you think the others should do. And everyone agreed on everything. I mean, Greg says, this is what I want to do. I was, you know, and he said, but I want to do the art, I want to do the display, I want to do creativity in my work. And he says, I don't want to have to negotiate deals with manufacturers, and I don't want to have to do answer to manufacturers if the sales aren't there, or, you know, the hard stuff.
Right, sure.
So it's okay. Let Paula do that. Paula needs to do that.
Paula's the edgy one.
And then when I talked to Paula, Paula said, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
And at that time, we didn't have Mace on Cheek. And Christy said, well, Paula needs to run the Butler Group sales agency. And she said, you know, with my Mary Kay background, I can really be a good cheerleader and and a sales manager of the people. And I'll do that.
Sure.
So
interesting. So things kind of fit. And did you bring everybody together at that point? And once you had interviewed everybody separately and say, hey, this is.
Well, I mean, it was by that time, it was pretty obvious. And we talked individually. And I said, next meeting, I said, you know what? Everybody agreed on everything. And it looks like this is the way we need to go. So wherever the holes are, we have to find somebody to hire somebody to do those necessary things that, maybe that aren't in there. And of course, everybody has to do some things that they may not think is the most fun, but has to fit into the job.
What did Betty say about the whole process? Was she kind of on board, and did she have thoughts in her head very similar?
Well, yeah, I think she knew the kids too, and thought the same thing. And her role and my role, we had to figure that out earlier. You know, we had already gone through that process between the two of us. So, she's the organizer. She's the one that is the detail person, and I'm the big picture person. And you know, and she often reminds me of that. She says, "You know, I know you're big picture, but don't forget the details. There's the detail."
Yeah, I know the feeling. Yeah. That's funny. So, how often do you guys do family meetings at this point?
We don't really schedule them to say we're going to do it every at a certain time, but there have been enough opportunities or needs that we say, you know, it's time to have a meeting, and let's have a family meeting about whatever it might be. And the most recent, you mentioned this recent family business forum that we had on goal setting, and prior to that meeting, I had a family council meeting with the people, our people, and I said, "I want you to think about goal setting, but this is not about the financial goals.
Right.
I want you to tell me what you enjoy doing, and let's revisit what we talked about several years ago now, and see how current that is and what has changed, because kids have gotten older, family situations have changed, and I just." Wrote up a little outline of questions to help lead the discussion. And we learned some new information from that will help us in redirecting, I think, some of the either requirements based on family needs or or make sure that we're, you know, everybody's happy and,
yeah,
and
taken
centered
care of
in what they're doing.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like, at least from what you're saying, relative to a lot of other families we talk to in here, you guys have a lot of consensus with where strengths and weaknesses are. And I guess it's just a matter with mom and dad kind of tweaking everything to make sure everybody's happy, right? Pretty much.
Well, that and also productive.
Right,
I mean,
sure.
We have to make sure that everybody is responsible financially in producing what the company needs to be able to support them and their families.
How do you create sort of, I guess, an ability where somebody, one daughter doesn't think the other daughter isn't pulling her weight? I mean, how do you hold everybody accountable? That's what I was trying to say.
That can be difficult. Mm-hmm. And we just, you know, it's something we have to address.
Right, sure.
And
like with any family, yeah.
Yeah, we just have to address it. It is different when it's a family instead of if it's an employee.
Right, it's a little easier.
Yeah, you just, you know, but after all, I mean, it's something that we just have to say, you know, well, you know, why is it? And what do we need to do to make it right? And
sure.
And everybody has to agree. But now one of the things that we are going to do now, and that is a look at each person's contribution to the company and their position with the company and determine what the salary should be for what they're doing.
Right, sure.
And what's right for them now may not be the same in 10 years.
Yeah, we always talk about fair is not equal and equal is not fair.
Right. And so now what we're thinking now is we separate the salary from ownership of the company and the dividends that the company might pay that person as owner. Yeah. So as we do that, then the person could still have the same amount of income at the end of the year. But
you might have more dividend income than
they
might
have more
salary.
But if they have more dividend income, then the other family members will also have that same dividend income.
Right.
And so some will get more money for more contribution to the company.
Sure. I think that's a great way of kind of settling so forth. So I understand family business, it's a fun place to be in, right? Well, good. Well, any other governance that you guys sort of have in place? I guess without any other kids, it isn't like you need anybody to do stints outside the company, but any other big?
Well, you know, we're thinking now about future generations.
Right.
Now, we have a granddaughter in college that has, it's Christy's daughter, told her mother that she changed her major in college to prepare for our family business.
Really?
So,
wow, that's really flattering.
That's a biggie.
Yeah,
yeah, it's really
a big deal.
Yeah.
So do you guys have her working in the business at all?
Well, she's in college, so she comes in and helps for a show set up when she can. And so we'll be working with her as much as she's available.
How do you guys balance? I mean, you're always working together, but how do you balance kind of family time or holiday dinners or with work? I mean, is work always discussed, or how do you guys kind of create the boundaries there?
Initially, we did have some rules about that. No no family business. Or like we have a Thanksgiving retreat. We all go away to the mountains in North Georgia in a cabin up there. It's a big, big place, and everybody can be in the same building. And so we limited to a point where we say, well, we're going to have a family council meeting on Friday, from 10 to 12 or something, you know, like that. And that way, and at that time, we can share what's going on with the grandchildren. Mm-hmm. So they kind of get a feel for what the business is. Well, we haven't really followed that religiously, and we did that a time or two, and then said, you know what? Just play.
Yeah.
Just have fun. And so we kind of said, you know, really no work unless you get permission or something.
Right.
So sometimes, for example, I mean, in November, it's a time of the year getting ready for the January show that we might have, we might be working with China on some product development.
Right, sure.
And I might get some images. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I tell Christy, I said, oh, you know what, we've got some images here. And so let's just schedule a little time. We can sit down, review them together.
Right.
That's fine. Let's do that. But we, you know, it's just like it's separated from the rest. And so we just don't, we don't let it monopolize our lives.
That's good.
And we do have a lot of family get togethers. We have a lot of, you know, every birthday celebration and mm-hmm. we get together and, you know, we don't talk about business.
That's
just
good.
Just family.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, Ed, as you know, near the end of each show, we like to ask all of our guests if you have three pearls of wisdom or tips that you could give other family businesses, what would you tell them?
Well, from my experience, and I certainly am not a, you know, I'm not an expert at this. I'm just learning like many other people that own businesses. But number one, I would say to allow each child to do what they enjoy mm-hmm. and to hire others to do the rest. I think people thrive that way. I think that is one difference in a family business versus a corporation that I was accustomed to in the past, where they might put you in a position that they think that fits you, mm-hmm. and you may or may not have any say about it.
Right.
With a family, you can really direct the child and do this as a partnership,
mm-hmm.
and it's much more flexible than non-family businesses.
That's good.
Two, the second one I'd say is to separate company ownership from job responsibilities. We talked about mm-hmm. that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And pay salaries
mm-hmm.
and bonuses based on performance and responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
But pay dividends for the company ownership.
Right.
And that's a good way to make the difference. And things can change that way too. And the third one, it's just from my experience, I say communicate with each child and together as a family. I also would say listen to the spouse
mm-hmm.
because they know what's going on with their mate.
Right.
And this can give you some good insights into things that you may be blind to.
Right. No, absolutely. Communication in any family business is huge, whether it's with the other owners or with your own spouse. So that's good. Well, listen, I really appreciate you coming on today. And if you can, if listeners wanted to get in touch with you, do you have a phone or an email where they could reach out to you?
Certainly. My office number is
404-577-6941. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And my email is ed@butler.com
Great. And again, we really appreciate you coming on, and best of luck to you.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure, Meredith.
And we want to remind our guests that we should have Ed's post show up by Tuesday or Wednesday of next week. And you can always go to our website to check it out at www.familybusinessradio.com.